This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
The lungs of the planet, they've been called. The great Amazon rainforest is shrinking again as humans expand our damage. We can study it or we can see photos from space, but what is happening in the forest on the ground? Campbell Plowden knows. He lived in the Peruvian Amazon jungle for a couple of years while getting his doctorate. Campbell travels there regularly. He knows the people and the reality. Dr. Campbell Plowden, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much, Alex.
How did you become a lifelong environmentalist?
Wow. I'd say quickly, my first passion was saving the whales, and I got involved with that for 14 years with Greenpeace and other organizations. And as we started making some good progress on that, I shifted my attention to the fate of the tropical rainforest, since that was really the ultimate endangered species issue. I got involved first at the global advocacy level, again with Greenpeace and other groups, trying to convince entities like the World Bank and some of the larger corporations to back off of what they were doing in the rainforest. But ultimately, I felt like I could make my best contribution, not trying to fight the big bad things at the global level, but really working at the very local level. So I went back to school, and in my late 40s, I went to the Brazilian Amazon and spent a couple years studying the ecology, management, and marketing of non-timber forest products. The idea being that if people who were living in the forest could make a living without harming the forest, then that would be a win for everyone.
And now you're the executive director at the Center for Amazon Community Ecology. What is community ecology?
Well, community ecology in an academic sense is really the study of the relationships between the organisms, plants, animals, the earth, and the sky. At the practical level, which I founded my group, it was really to focus on that relationship between people and the forest environment. Again, the idea being that when conservation is approached only in terms of, well, let's save this animal or let's save this tree, it's really going to fall short unless you take account of the people in the environment. And so our goal at the center is to help forest peoples make a living with a focus on developing innovative and fair trade non-timber forest products. And the two areas that we focus on most are handicrafts and essential oils.
And back in my own ancient days as a musician, I remember seeing rosewood guitars. What happened to the rosewood tree?
Well, you've partially explained the answer to that question, which is that rosewood and many other tropical timbers are undoubtedly beautiful. Rosewood had kind of a double whammy against it because it had beautiful timber, but it also was very heavily exploited for producing essential oils used in perfumes and other fragrances. And so when they began harvesting the rosewood, they just basically cut down the entire trees. And when they ran out of those, they started digging up the roots and processing those. So rosewood became an endangered species and is on the list of species which is basically not allowed in international trade when you're talking about trees taken from the wild. But one thing that we've been doing with our partner organization, Comino Verde, is to plant, our goal is to plant thousands of new rosewood trees, and we have just now started being able to harvest the branches with our partners. So there really are ways that you can use the forest without damaging it if you do it carefully.
So you're just taking the branches without killing the whole tree, and that way it's sustainable?
Absolutely. You know, as trees grow up, they naturally lose some of their lower branches, so we're just basically doing the pruning job that nature would do eventually, grinding up those branches and leaves and extracting the oil from it. And the idea there is that we can produce a high-value product, which is obviously still sought after by many people, but give the local people an income and an incentive to let those trees grow larger and ultimately help repopulate the rainforest with rosewood.
Could you tell us a bit more about the Camino Verde project? Like, where is it? Who's involved?
Sure. The center partners with another nonprofit group that's called Camino Verde. They're both a U.S. and a Peruvian non-governmental group. Their main operations base is in southern Peru, and they have a reforestation center there, which they've been operating for the last 12 years, where they've planted many tens of thousands of trees of over 350 species. So they were a perfect partner for us to bring in their expertise with reforestation and our connections to rainforest communities up in northern Peru. So we've been working together to plant the trees there, grind up the material, as I described, and distill it into the oil. Camino Verde has already started doing something similar with a rosewood relative down at their center in southern Peru and have been selling that. So we're now basically going through all of the legal steps to export the rosewood oil. And it's quite a lengthy process because we need to demonstrate that we've been doing it from trees that we've planted and not involved in the ongoing cutting of the older trees that are still remnants out there in the rainforest.
And you led an Amazon Forest Roadshow in the Northeast U.S., I believe. What would we see at your booth?
Well, we've been going to music festivals in as far as Kentucky, Maryland, Pennsylvania, New York. I've been to Rhode Island. And the idea there is that with our handicrafts, they are made by several hundred artisans from our 15 partner communities in northern Peru. They're gorgeous crafts that are woven from the Chambira palm tree and carved from other natural materials. So we've been working with the communities to make different kinds of products than they would normally sell to the tourists down there. So they're bags, guitar straps, wide variety of jewelry. And so in our booth, we have the crafts, but we also want that to be an opportunity for people to connect with the people of the forest. So very simply, we have a lot of photos showing the artisans at work. We also have the rainforest puzzle. We have our daily science trivia questions and our daily mural. So we invite people to use our dry erase markers and just draw a picture of a plant or an animal from the rainforest that inspires them. And we also talk to people a lot. So whenever people come in and say, well, what is this about? You know, this is a very different kind of booth. We'll talk to them about our work and ask them where they've traveled and try to help them understand that buying something from us is not just buying a commodity. It's making an investment in the future of the Amazon.
And how can people find out when you're going to show up with this?
Well, the best way is through our website, and that's www.amazonecology.org. And we've actually just finished up a very ambitious summer season. So I'm going back to Peru for 6 weeks, actually next week, and I'll come back with a variety of crafts again. And then we'll be doing some sales around the Christmas time. But we're also in the process of developing an online store that's called the Amazon Forest Store. And that's www.amazonforeststore.org. And so people will have an opportunity to buy some of these crafts online as well.
How long does it take a person in the Amazon to make one of these craft projects? Say your anaconda guitar straps, which incidentally are not made from anaconda snake skins.
Right. Well, the process for making these crafts is a pretty intricate one. First, someone will go out in the forest and they will cut a couple of leaves, and we call them leaf spears because when they're cut, they're about 6 to 8 feet long, and then they will take off the leaflets from that, bring them back to the village, and there they will sit down and one by one grasp the bottom of a leaflet with their between their big toe and their next toe, and then very adroitly pull out the fibers from the leaf. And the skilled artisans will end up with a piece that's maybe 3-4 feet long. And then they will wash those, dry them in the sun. And then the next day they'll go out and collect the berries, barks, leaves, roots of other plants and boil those dye plant materials with the Chambira fiber to turn it yellow, orange, purple, or a number of other colors. And then the next process is they will twine it on their thigh, so they're actually rubbing together the fibers to get it to the right thickness, and then they can begin the process of weaving it. So with the Anaconda guitar strap, for instance, they'll have a long board with about 8 nails in it and tie the fibers around. So they'll start out with a very long series of strands and then weave across until they eventually have the pattern that they want. So from start to finish, you know, we're talking probably a couple of days to prepare the plant materials and then another couple of days to actually weave the guitar strap.
Well, let's jump up to the big picture a bit. This year, scientists from Brazil and the UK released a paper showing that the uptick in Amazon forest destruction is now less from giant agro industry and forest companies as it has been in the past, and more from incursions of small plots. What is going on there?
Well, as it's been going on for a long time now, you know, when you have countries with a lot of population in the big cities, you know, there's been a natural tendency in some cases for governments to encourage people to go out into the rainforest as a way of siphoning off some of that excess energy in the city. And so when you have people who are not used to being in the rainforest, either they're city people or they've been used to a farming tradition in other areas, you know, they'll go into the rainforest and cut down a patch and typically plant crops such as manioc or corn. And for people who've been living in the forest for a long time, what they typically do is they will then establish an agroforestry system where, yes, they will have their staple crops, but they'll also be planting a wide variety of fruit trees and other trees that will produce fibers and medicinal plants in the future. But with, again, some of the newer people coming in, they're not familiar with those techniques. And so they may just plant the cash crops, do that for a couple years, let it go, and then they're off to burning another patch of forest again. So you have too many people going through the forest too fast, and that's really what accelerates the deforestation. Where you have people who've been living in the forest for a long time, they're able to maintain that kind of lifestyle without having a net increase to the amount of forest that they're cutting and burning every year.
Is it possible to regulate that? I mean, I'm thinking of Brazil's efforts to curb illegal logging, and they were doing better, but now we have Jair Bolsonaro. He's the front runner for Brazilian president in the upcoming elections. He's been called Brazil's Trump, and he was seriously attacked this month at a rally. If elected, I wonder if he will undo all the curbs on Amazon deforestation that were set in motion by President Lula, who's now in jail for corruption. It's very complicated at the highest levels trying to regulate what happens in the Amazon.
Well, I think that's an understatement. You know, Brazil did have, or presumably still has, a law that means that people are not allowed to clear more than half or a certain percentage of the land that they own. And they had a very aggressive program in place using satellite imagery to actually monitor that and find people who abused it. But, you know, any law that's made can be a law that's unmade. And the other thing is that if the agencies in charge of monitoring that are not properly supported and funded, then those efforts can certainly go backwards.
The word Amazon itself makes most of us think of Brazil. Is Peru's Amazon large, and how would you rate their protection efforts?
Well, the Amazon is certainly a very large area. It's the Amazon rainforest itself is about the size of the continental United States. So most of it is in Brazil, but there are other good chunks of it in Peru, Ecuador, Bolivia, Colombia, Venezuela, and the Guyanas. Peru, I believe, is, you know, it's a mixed bag. Governments both at the central level and at the what we would call the state level have been creating a very impressive number of protected areas. But the catch, of course, is that creating a protected area is great on a map, but it really is only effective if it's enforced on the ground. And the reality is that you're just never going to hire enough guards to try to keep people and bad activities out. So, you know, really that's where efforts like my organization and others come in, which is that an area is only going to be protected if the people living around it can make a living from the forest resources in a sustainable way. And that means that they can make a living without resorting to illegal logging, without resorting to, you know, just outright illegal colonization, big cattle ranching projects. The one area that I think is scary seeing developing in Peru now is that, as we've seen, oil palm plantations have been criticized for various environmental and social impacts in Brazil and Asia. Big oil palm plantations are now coming into Peru as well. And so they are taking areas that had been very acceptable secondary forests and mowing them down and putting in these oil palm monocultures.
That's a huge problem all over the world.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with a feet-on-the-ground interview with Dr. Campbell Plowden from the Amazon Center for Community Ecology. You know, Campbell, normally I try not to promote any products or business on Radio EcoShock, but your project really got me thinking. Maybe environmentalism is too purist. We don't want to get busy with solutions on the ground. Your thoughts about that relationship between environmentalism and being an entrepreneur?
Well, Alex, I think having worked in the advocacy realm, you know, I certainly believe that in order to make progress on this issue, you need to have people acting along the full spectrum of possibilities. You need to be working and lobbying governments to have policies that protect rather than encourage deforestation. You need to have advocacy campaigns like groups like Amazon Watch that are highlighting the activities of some of the fossil fuel companies that are going in and doing oil drilling in the middle of the Amazon where they have no business doing so. But I also believe that, you know, just putting areas off limits is also not realistic, not practical, and not ethical. There are hundreds of thousands of people who live in the forest, and they need to have a viable way to make a living without harming the forest. So I think that's where my organization and others trying to do similar things have a vital role to play. So, you know, by making handicrafts, by doing essential oils, and there's many other food-related projects going on at the local level, people need to have something that they can be looking forward to and not just things that they're opposing.
You know, some scientists suggest huge areas of the Amazon will convert to grasslands as human emissions overheat the planet. What have you heard about the long-term future of the Amazon?
You know, I can't honestly say that I'm an expert on that really big picture, but what I can say, you know, from what I've observed in Peru over the last 10 years or so, is that global warming is having an impact already. You know, we don't have to look years into the future for disaster scenarios to see that global warming is having an impact. And what I've observed in the last some years is that when you have particularly warm years, that can affect the ice melt from the glaciers in the Andes. And then you see large amounts of water coming down the Andes that then make their way through Amazon communities. So a couple of the communities where we work, they're very used to seasonal flooding. They build their house on stilts. But in a couple of severe years, those floods came up higher than the stilts on their houses. They came up well into the fields that are normally unflooded. So we had, you know, in the Iquitos area around Peru, tens of thousands of people who were displaced by these extra high floods. And they lost their ability to grow food because their crop fields were flooded. They lost their ability to make money because all the plants that they relied on to make the crafts, for instance, were also flooded. So, you know, we're having to see adjustments in a lot of different ways from this sort of large-scale activity.
It's interesting you raise that because what I've been hearing is the number of cities in South America that could be in real trouble when those glaciers are gone, because that's where their water's coming from. But you're showing the other side of it. The rapid melt is flooding places in bad ways.
Well, certainly, you know, I think we would see the flooding effects in the short term. But, you know, what you're describing is obviously a very real concern in the medium to long term.
From the world scientists that I interview, I hear more predictions of doom for the climate and the biosphere, and yet society does not react. Sometimes I wonder if we do need a kind of shift in environmental consciousness to spread with the speed and the passion that religion has in the past. Do you have roots with the Society of Friends, and did that help shape your journey?
Yeah, very much so. I've been an environmentalist my whole life, but when I got involved with Greenpeace, I was inspired to find that the roots of the Greenpeace movement were in the Quaker faith, the Religious Society of Friends. And in the early 90s, I started attending a Quaker meeting and found that for me personally, the testimonies of Friends in terms of simplicity and integrity and care for stewardship of the planet were very consistent with what I wanted to achieve with my environmental work. And so while Friends have been supportive of my work by buying crafts and small grants here and there, for me, it's really having a spiritual backing to my work that keeps me going when times are tough, as you say. If you look at the numbers, it's very easy to be pessimistic about the long-term outcome. But, for me, I just couldn't do what I do without some faith that people can figure this out and care for each other and care for the planet and figure out a way to move forward.
And I was going through your Facebook page and found your SoundCloud anti-whaling ditty you wrote in 1988. It was so cool. So now, when you hit 50 years of green campaigning, which you will in a few years, do you think you'll write a book, or what have you got planned?
Oh, gosh. I actually started writing a book called Journey with the Tembe, which was focusing on the couple of years that I lived with the Tembe Indians in the eastern Brazilian Amazon. And I was very much enjoying the process of trying to tell some of those stories and some of the painful lessons I learned doing that. But I just found it very hard to multitask efficiently. I was sort of caught between, can I spend a lot of time writing about what I've done or focus on the work I'm doing now? And so for the time being, I'm just trying to do the work I'm doing now and hope I can tell the stories later.
I'm in exactly the same place. I've got some fantastic interviews that I've done over 13 years now of broadcasting. I'd love to go back and transcribe some of them and add some comments and weave them all together, but I'm too busy working on the next interviews for next week's show. So I guess at some point, we just make a decision to keep on keeping on.
Well, I'm now 60. I'm going to be 65 years old this December, which sounds very odd to say since I got involved with Greenpeace when I was 23. But I feel like I'm still going strong. But at some point, I will probably retire from active duty, as it were. And I really do hope to focus a lot of time on writing when I get to that stage.
So when you're not in the Amazon, where do you live and how do you connect locally?
I currently live in State College, Pennsylvania. I came here for graduate school in 1995, and 23 years later, it's been a wonderful place to raise my family with my wife and two children who are now out in the world. Actually, I'm going to be moving to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania in a couple months where my wife has a new job, but we'll stay connected. Both to the Friends meeting, and I'll be doing some of the same craft shows that we've been doing. It's been great to be near Penn State University. Came here for graduate school, and a number of the board members and advisors to the center are Penn State faculty. So having access to some of the best minds who dealt with issues of forestry and tropical ecology and sociology and rural economics has just been a fantastic resource to have at hand.
And from your viewpoint, are we seeing a new generation of environmentally conscious youth? Or, and I hate to say this fearful thing, was it just a baby boomer thing?
Well, certainly the environmental movement is carrying on. Every generation has its new most pressing issues. When I got involved, the Save the Whales, anti-nuclear movement, and we are concerned about global winter from impact of nuclear war. And obviously now global warming has become a very important issue. We've gone through a lot of concerns about the impact of globalization, about technology, biotechnology. And so, you know, I think young people are very much concerned about a variety of environmental and related social issues. You know, the way that they're going about that now is certainly different with the technology and social media at hand. I think big rallies don't play quite the role that they used to. But on the other hand, where people can organize and make their opinions known through various devices on the Internet can make a big difference as well.
As we wrap up, could you take us there? Perhaps tell us a story about something that surprised you about living with the actual people in the Amazon.
For me, the biggest lessons of living with native people in the Amazon and working with them over time has been that the intimate knowledge that they have of the forest is really remarkable. You know, it's almost a cliche to talk about that. But when I was able to walk through the forest with people like Lodival, one of the older chiefs of the Tembe, and have him tell me about how this particular bark was good for treating diarrhea. And then Moreira would tell a story about how he remembered as a boy hunting an animal in that particular spot. So people have an intimate historical connection to the forest that I think it's very difficult for people in developed countries to relate to. But on the other hand, it's not fair and it's not right to romanticize that indigenous people want to stay poor. They really have a desire and a right to improve their standard of living. They want many of the benefits that we enjoy and take for granted in modern life. So the challenge really is, how can we work with people as partners so that we can help them use their intimate knowledge of the forest and combine that with some of their cultural traditions, but also use our savvy with being entrepreneurs, but do so in a way that is compatible with keeping the forest intact and can support the development of their communities without just making them replicas of ours.
There are people who talk and people who do. Dr. Campbell Plowden does both. He is the executive director at the Center for Amazon Community Ecology. You can get links from my show blog, but find out more at www.amazonecology.org. That's pretty easy to remember, amazonecology.org. Campbell, it's been great talking with you. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. It is time for me to be gone for this week. Please join the party again next week on Radio EcoShock.